When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Motor Mouth podcast with Harry Benjamin and Tim Sylvie. This is the place where we meet some of the biggest names in and around motorsport, chat about their lives and everything in between.
We've partnered with the Brain Tumor Charity, helping to raise awareness and help find a cure. Thanks to our partnership, we've been able to create a short series of special podcasts uncovering those within the motorsport community who've been affected by those devastating diagnoses. You can hear those stories and more, including the Williams F1 team's planning director, Richard Jones, right now on your chosen podcast player. The charity work all year round to help develop research and raise awareness. And if you're looking to challenge yourself this new year, why not sign up to the Brain Tumor Charity's Brain Power Challenge? Simply choose a challenge that will boost your brain health, from meditation to 10K runs to mega Sudoku, and set your challenge to either silver, gold, or platinum difficulty level. Every penny you raise will be spent on the charity's medical research. £250 covers the cost of one day of world-class medical research into kinder and better treatments for brain tumours, which really does make a difference. Follow the Brain Tumor Charity on social media to learn more and to sign up. Boost your brain today to boost other brains tomorrow, because a cure can't wait. This podcast is brought to you by F1 Experiences, the official experience, hospitality and travel program of Formula One. F1 Experiences is the closest you can get to the pinnacle of motorsport. And let's face it, any chance to get close to Formula One this year, we're all over it. Enjoy the very best race tickets and track hospitality, first-class hotels and unprecedented access you simply cannot get anywhere else. For more information on how you can book your F1 experience, visit f1experiences.com, where you can also save 5% on your very own F1 experiences package by using the code MOTORMOUTH when checking out online. So, what are you waiting for? Experience the 2022 F1 season firsthand with exclusive access courtesy of F1 Experiences. Get booking today at f1experiences.com.
Hello, my name's Tim Sylvie, and today we're joined by a man who hails from Bromley in the UK, but now resides in lovely Suffolk. And did you know, Harry, that Suffolk is home to the smallest pub in Britain? Yes, you can find the Nutshell in Bury St Edmunds, which measures just 15 by 7 feet. But, Harry, can you tell me what else Suffolk is famous for in racing? Not the car variety, but horse racing. So the British home of horse racing in Suffolk is found at...
the British... Hang on, say that again. The British...
The home of British horse racing.
Horse racing. I don't know my horse. Ascot's the only place I know.
Completely wrong. Newmarket. And I bet you knew that, didn't you?
I did know that because I spent 3 years in Norwich. That's not too far away from Suffolk.
Norfolk. Once again, appalling.
I'm disappointed in myself. You know what? My brain's not really turned on at the moment. It's still, fair enough. For me, it's still early. I don't come alive till the afternoon.
Also, your brain is full of Formula 3 statistics, because this weekend, you have a very exciting weekend ahead of you. It's your first Formula 3 commentary.
in Bahrain. Well, you're not in Bahrain, but you'll be at Biggin Hill commentating.
Don't ruin the illusion.
You're kicking off on Friday. How's the revision going? Are you excited?
Yeah, no, I'm really looking forward to it. It should be good fun. I've done one race last year filling in for the legendary Alex Jakes, but I've got the gig full time this year, which is exciting. So first race Bahrain, first time Formula 3 is in Bahrain as well. And it's great because obviously it's F1, F2 and F3 all together, jam-packed schedule. And it's, you know, it's a 30-car grid. It's absolute wow. Mayhem. Great young drivers, you know, 16-year-olds all the way up to, I think the oldest driver is about 22, something like that.
Ancient.
So, you know, a few that are backed by some big F1 teams as well. So it should be fairly exciting, fingers crossed.
Well, look, best of luck with it. I'm sure it'll go swimmingly. I look forward to hearing your dulcet tones on my my TV. Right, should we go on to today's show?
I think so. Let's do it.
So today we're joined by Mr. Gary Paffett, a DTM champion, factory Mercedes AMG driver, a former Formula E driver and subsequently technical advisor. He's had roles with McLaren Mercedes and Williams in Formula One. He's racked up almost 200 race starts, multiple wins, podiums and pole positions. He's father to three boys and is partial to a spot of tennis and cycling. It's our pleasure to have him here to talk about his life, career, opinions and views. Gary Paffett, welcome to the Motormouth podcast.
Thank you very much. Very much. Good morning.
Good morning, Gary. Now, are you Suffolk based at the moment in this very time? You're near Newmarket or are you, where are you these days?
I knew the answer to that question. I've been to the home of horse racing itself, the where it was born. So, live very close to there. So, I knew that one, but yes, I'm in Suffolk. I'm based near Bury St Edmunds at the moment. So,
oh, nice.
Yes. I have been here for quite a while now. So yeah.
Oh, very nice. Well, we like to sort of dive into all of our guests' careers so far, where they come from. And every time I ask this first question, it always feels like it should be a question you ask in therapy. It's always like, well, take us back to, you know, how was your childhood? Was it good? You know, how were things growing up? But I suppose the bones of it are, was racing always there at the start? How did, you know, the bug bite you?
It came from my father, effectively. I mean, he is a motorhead himself. You know, he was always a car mechanic at garages, fixing cars and things like that, and used to race himself. He used to race rallies and things like that in a motor club just for, you know, for fun. And then went on to doing 210 Villa gearbox kart racing with a friend of his. So he was always interested in motorsport and racing himself. And, you know, he would also go on trips to, you know, he went to Monza to see F1 there, and he'd go and watch F1 races. So he was he's always been a big motorhead. And then when I was 8 years old, I think for Christmas he bought me a kart, and it started from there. And I think, you know, at the time, lots of people had different stories. At the time, my story was that it was just to go and have a bit of fun racing. You know, there was no, I say no ambition. Obviously you want to enjoy it, but the only ambition was to have fun and enjoy racing, because that was my dad's passion, really. So I don't remember much about you know, being interested in motorsport before then. I don't remember much before the age of about 8, really, to be honest. So I don't think many people do, really. So to say that I've always loved it would be a lie, because I don't know, I probably did, but my parents talk about the fact that I always used to play with my toy cars and always used to do that, pretend races and stuff. So I guess I've always been interested in racing and cars. But then I obviously really kicked off when I started, when I was 9 years old.
I'm always interested to find out how people transition from karts into cars. And you move from karting into single seaters, where you immediately did very well, taking 4 titles in 5 years. How did that transition from karts to single seaters happen? Were you guided through that, or did it? Were you picked up? Were you spotted? What was that process like?
As you said, the karting went very well. You know, I think it quite quickly it went from just enjoying it, having a bit of fun as a family, to I'm quite good at this, and it kind of just went from there, you know, and became more and more successful. I got picked up by Martin Heinz, who owned Zipcar at the time, which were, you know, certainly at the time the biggest karting manufacturers in the UK, one of the best teams out there. So I got picked up by Zipcar, and I raced with them in karting all the way through until 96, when I won the Junior ICA Championship, and then it kind of got to a natural end, really. And we were, waiting to move into cars. And actually, I did a year in Formula A in karting, just actually to fill a gap. Mm. You know, with zero ambition, we had me and one mechanic, a friend of mine who used to tune my engine, Sean's Pits, and we had a small, not these transit vans you see now, one of the small boxy ones.
Yeah.
Just chucked a couple of carts and just travelled the UK for a year, just competing, you know, just to keep doing something. It went pretty well actually, but that was it. And then end of 97, when I was old enough, we went racing in cars. And actually, we Zipkart as a company bought a car, and we went racing bought a car, and that's how we went racing. You know, we didn't go and join a team. We didn't look at anything else. The guys, there was one of the engineers that had been there for a long time engineering, started engineering Martin Hines gearbox cars when he was racing. He'd run Zipkart and as an engineering point of view, and decided to see if he could engineer a race car. And that was it. You know, him, me, my dad, and a truckie.
So cool. And did you, was something, this is going to make you feel really old. So when were you born, Harry? 98?
Seven.
97. So when Gary started taking racing seriously, you were basically in nappies. That's terrifying.
Yeah, I definitely, well, you can't remember before the age of eight. I certainly can't remember that. So,
the funny thing is, you say about the transition from cars to cars and how successful it was. Now, if anybody was at the first test I did in a race car at Snetterton, they would not agree that it was that successful straight away.
Yeah. It takes, you've got to get used to things, haven't
you? Slipping and sliding.
Yeah, the downforce and all of that sort of stuff. You've got to hone your craft, I suppose. But it must have been an interesting time of your career, if you can remember these bits. I don't remember anything before I was about 12. My mind is blank. So, but you did go on to win, which I assume you remember this bit, the McLaren Autosport BIDC Young Driver of the Year Award in 1999. So Harry's sort of moving up through his toddler stage. And then as part of that, the reward for that, you got yourself an F1 test for McLaren. Take us through that time of your career. That must have been hugely exciting.
It was. You know, I think the move into cars was a massive step compared to what I'd done before. And it went pretty well. Our approach, which it had to be the approach, was that I had to keep winning. You know, there was no choice. There was no way of succeeding. There wasn't a pot of money. We didn't have money year on year to path the way forward. You know, that's why when I did Formula Vauxhall Junior in 98, the first year we did the Class B, which I went and won quite convincingly. The reason for that was that, again, I had to win to be able to make, to be able to get the promotion and the success for the next year. Then, you know, I went on to win the Class A Championship in 99. I got a prize fund for doing that, which helped pay for the next season. Again, went into Class B, the national class of Formula 3. I think won every race in the UK doing that. And then, but that was actually called a scholarship class. And I won £125,000 by winning that, which then again paid for a big part of my budget in Formula 3 in Germany the next year. You know, I did two years out. So, yeah, at the end of 99, I got nominated for the McLaren Autosport, which at the time was a big thing. To be in the top six drivers in British drivers at that time was massive. So getting nominated was a great achievement. And then I went to the testing, which went well. Nobody expected me to win. Really, they really didn't. You know, the people I was up against had more experience, higher profile. You know, they were expected to win. And when I'd won it, it was a massive surprise for a lot of people. So that was the first major step in my career. Stood up there with David Coulthard receiving the award, and then getting the opportunity to test the McLaren after that was huge. You know, it was absolutely huge. Through the karting links, with McLaren supporting some of the series, we had a quite good relationship with McLaren anyway. So the test actually got the reward test got delayed quite a lot. And waited for a good opportunity. So they were quite nice to me, whereas a lot of the drivers get an hour in the car at a wet, damp Silverstone. I went out to Jerez for a full day's testing in Jerez in the sun.
Oh, lovely. You got treated.
Yeah, I did get treated. Yeah, I got unfairly treated, but I don't care.
How was that then, those first moments getting into that F1 car and leaving the pits? You know, what was that like? I imagine it was nothing like you'd ever experienced before.
No, I mean, I'd driven an F3 car before that, and it's just incredible. You know, the step in performance and power and everything with a car like that was just incredible. You know, this was back in the days of the big V10 engines with the massive wings, huge amounts of downforce. I mean, it was incredible experience. I think we were driving down to, we flew out to Spain, driving down to the circuit on the day before I was supposed to test. And I got a call from the team manager at the time, said, whereabouts are you? And I said, well, we're about half an hour out. He's like, okay, so we finished testing for the day. So if you get it quick, you can have a run today as well. So I was like, you know, you're looking forward to that day of just, you know, getting used to the team, having a good night's sleep. And it was like, no, get in the car now, you know, you're off. So I did a run the day before I was supposed to test, just a shakedown run, which was good. And then I started the normal day, and I think I did 14 laps, and it felt like my neck was going to fall off, you know. And I was, but apparently that's normal for most people that get in there first. But you think, wow, this is incredible. But I did a day that went incredibly well. You know, this was in December 2000. Included so well that they invited me back in January to go and do some more testing with them in MagnaCore, and the kind of relationship started there with McLaren. It kind of broke up for certain reasons over a couple of years, and we lost contact. But then obviously back in 2005, I joined them full-time as a test driver. But yeah, that first experience was just like nothing else, just incredible.
I was going to say, with that first experience though, did that change your sort of mindset and your goals? Because I know you said earlier on that, you know, you didn't really know where you were going, that sort of be where the end result might be. But were you thinking now, okay, well, I want to be a Formula One driver, that's it?
Yeah, I think that already happened earlier, really, that I wanted to be a Formula One driver. You know, once you start getting success in karting and you start realizing yourself, yeah, I'm pretty good at this, you know, I can do well at this. Well, obviously, like I say, the path wasn't laid for me to get there, because we were still going year by year, trying to find a budget, trying to find a way. So it wasn't as if, right, in 4 years' time, I'm going to be there. But then when I got to drive the F1 car and how well the test went, at that point, you think, yeah, I can do this. You know, this is something I can realistically, you know, try and achieve.
Yeah.
It's the sort of thing you find step by step as you go. You know, trying to prove to yourself how good you are, really.
And motorsport isn't without its challenges. I mean, you up until this point, it sounds like everything's going relatively smoothly, but there are always hurdles and roadblocks. And financial troubles derailed an F3000 drive in 2003, but it didn't necessarily hamper your career, because you went on to get into DTM and Mercedes. How did that process happen? Was there a point where you thought, oh God, that F3000 drive is screwed, what am I going to do now? And then the DTM opportunity came. What was that process like?
Yeah, as you say, I mean, there's even before that, there's times where it didn't go as planned. So end of 2000, when I did my first year of F3 in the UK, the plan was obviously to go and do F3 in the UK in the main championship. And plans for that were going well until they got renegaded by a driver with a father with better links than me and more money. And that was already in probably January, February of 2001. So then we had a very late call to try and find a drive, which meant I moved over to Germany to race with Team Rosberg over there. So that's when I first moved out of the country and went to race abroad. And then, as you say, end of 2002, I'd won the German Formula 3 Championship, and I got a test in a DTM car with Mercedes. So I went along, I did a test in the car, and that went very well. And they offered me a drive for 2003 in DTM. I turned that down because my ambition was still single seaters. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I turned that down because my ambition was still single seaters, and that's what I was looking for. Again, we had an offer from a team doing a new team to F3000 that had big prospects of major sponsorship, and it was one of them where you get we were suckers, really, actually, yeah. Probably, but you know, it was there. You know, you had this person with all of the the sponsorship things with Coca-Cola and Virgin and all this over the car, and we're doing this, we're doing that, and promised a lot, but then quite quickly the sort of wheels started to come off, and after we did the first official test in Barcelona, went incredibly well. By the next test in Imola, the engineers had left because they hadn't been paid. So we had chief mechanics engineer in the car at Imola for the test. Then we went to Imola for the first race, which was a disaster just because the team wasn't run properly. And then the Monday after the first race at Imola, which at that time was already quite far through the year, it was in May, I think, the guy called us up and said, okay, that's it, the team's closed.
Oh, no.
So I got to May and didn't have a drive. Now, a very fortunate sequence of events that happened threw me a lifeline. So effectively, Mercedes, Uwe Alzheimer had an argument with Mercedes, who was one of their works Mercedes DTM drivers at the time. He had an argument shortly before the first race with them about something, and they got rid of him, or he left, whatever happened. Then Christian Albers, who is in a Rosberg DTM car, got promoted to the works team. So he took his car. And they put Patrick Heusman in the Rosberg car as a temporary fill-in while they sorted out permanent plans. That was for two races. Then, after I lost this drive, this was noticed by Arno Zenzen from Team Rosberg, who I'd raced with in F3 for 2 years. So he knew me well, obviously. He was the person that had a seat possibly available. So two days after, I got a phone call saying, there's no drive. I had a phone call from him saying, do you want to drive a DTM car?
A quick interruption to the show to remind you to check out our sponsor, F1 Experiences. F1 Experiences offer a wide range of packages that come direct from Formula One, giving you a unique experience of the pinnacle of motorsport. Official ticket packages come with the very best race tickets, first-class hotels and transfers, and unprecedented access, including track tours, pit lane walks, VIP hospitality, and loads more. It really is the closest you can get to Formula One. And thanks to F1 Experiences, you can return to the track this year, and Motormouth listeners can save 5% on your next F1 experience package by using.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The code Motormouth when booking online at f1experiences.com.
Wow, the universe works in mysterious ways.
A week later, I was at Nürburgring racing my first DTM race as a professional driver.
God, what a baptism of fire as well. Nürburgring. There you go. Just go and drive one of the toughest tracks on the planet.
I crashed on the first lap.
Yeah, so not so bad.
But I mean, what a lifeline to be thrown as well. And obviously, you know, DTM in that era, I suppose, was really, you know, getting better and better, and it was sort of the classic eras, I suppose, was great DTM racing. How did you enjoy it then once you properly got into it? And, you know, it wasn't before long you were made an AMG Mercedes Works driver and going for the championship. And ultimately, you did take the crown in 2005. The same year, you then signed, as you said earlier, for McLaren as an F1 tester. So all of a sudden, from nearly having nothing to suddenly everything coming at you in the next couple of years.
Yeah, it was incredible. Turnaround. You know, I got to grips with the car relatively quickly. We had a couple of really good races in 2003 in what was, you know, a year old car effectively. So I had a couple of really good races where I scored good points, finished sixth at Red Bull Ring, especially which impressed a lot of people. And then, yeah, as you say, I got promoted to the works team for 2004 as because the works team had four drivers at that point. So I got promoted to the works team as effectively the fourth driver in the lineup. You know, there was Bernschneider was still there, Jean Lacy, in his prime years of DTM, and myself joining as the fourth driver of the team. I went on to finish second to Matthias Ekström and beat all three of them that year, which was nice. I won my first race in the car at Hockenheim, which is incredible start to the year. And actually, 2005 I won the championship, and 2004 I think was actually probably a better year, to be honest. I got disqualified from one race, from one win for running out of fuel. I think in 2004 I won five races in a row, which was incredible. I said I got disqualified from one. Another one of them was an invitational race we did in Shanghai in that year, which didn't count for points anyway. 2004 for me was as good, certainly, as 2005 was. The difference was there was no expectation in 2004. 2005, suddenly, okay, now you're expected to win. And 2005 was one of the most incredible seasons of racing I've ever had, to be honest.
Yeah, an incredible year. And like Harry said, you won the championship and you became a mainstay in DTM. 2007, 2008, 2009, of course, 2010, when you narrowly missed out on your second title, losing out to Harry's idol, PDR. Love a bit of Paul D'Resta.
His idol.
Oh,
wow.
Not an idol.
I'm underplaying it. It's more than an idol. It's like...
No. I was just a fan of Paul D'Resta, right? I was just a little bit of a fan, and then I met him, and I heard a lot of things about him, so then I met him, and he was an all right guy. And idol's a strong word.
Do you have a model of Paul D'Resta's car in the room that you're in right now?
I actually have his DTM car.
Yeah,
sorry, Gary.
Exactly.
I do actually have his DTM car. Yeah. I do. I know.
I mean, who has that? But, who has that?
Yeah, I don't know.
I have some models.
Oh, is it
mine?
It's another PDR fan. Oh, of your car.
But you know what? Actually, you know what? Yeah. I always, Gary, when I got into DTM, I started watching it in 2012, maybe. And that was when I kind of became really fascinated by like racing properly and motorsport and wanted to kind of get involved. There's a Euronics store down my road. Mm. And every time I walk past it, all I could think about was your DTM livery from those years with the Euronics label. Because I was like, I've never seen a Euronics store anywhere else apart from down my road. And then I saw it on a DTM car and I was like, oh, okay.
Well, they
must
be
fairly big.
The regulations changed in 2012, didn't they? There was a relatively big shift. Was that a good... Casting your mind back, was that a good thing? Did that help or hinder?
It helped me. It helped me for sure, because I'd been there quite a long time in DTM. So it was some years you have good years, some years you don't have great years. But one thing was for sure that I was always thought of as a very good test driver and developer of a car. So whenever we had a new car, a new concept, I always got to test it quite a lot because that's where they get the most progress. So when we had the new car in 2012, I did most of the testing, which gave me a bit of an advantage over the others, but also got the car up to speed as quick as it could have done. So for 2012, it was one of them years. The car felt pretty horrible, actually, when I first tested it. You know, it had bigger wheels. It had a big carbon chassis instead of the space frame metal chassis. And it felt a bit heavy and a bit cumbersome, to be honest. When we did the first testing, it had a paddle shift instead of the stick shift. And it was, it didn't feel amazing to start with, really. Actually, when I first tested the car at Hungary, I thought, it just feels a bit slow, to be honest. But, you know, we developed the car, got the car feeling better, and then went to the first race at Hockenheim and just destroyed everyone. I mean, just absolutely destroyed everyone. I mean, myself, I think Jamie Green got the lead from me earlier in the race. And I kind of hunted him down, overtook him, and the pair of us were miles clear of anyone else. And the thing is that every year is the same. You never know how quick you are until you get to that first race. And you finish that first race and go, wow, this is something else, this car. I lost that championship in the end, though, so there was people caught up. But yeah, it was definitely, when you have something like this, it's nice to have a fresh start, you know, and that was what it was really for me at that point, was a fresh start with a new car, and it did sort of, push us on. And that year, you know, I finished second in the championship four times in DTM. That year hurt. That year was tough, to be honest. The hardest. I think after that season, that was the toughest I've ever felt, and the most time I've had to have away to deal with things. think I was leading by something like 40 points or something. I mean, it was a huge lead. And BMW just overdeveloped us during the second part of the year, and they caught up and they, you know, beat me by a couple of points in the end. Bruno beat me by a couple of points in the end, which was more even worse because I really don't like Bruno Spengler after being his teammate for many years. So that was tough to take, to be honest. Yeah.
Oh, well, that's the clip. We'll put that out there on the socials. Clip that up nicely.
He knows it. Honestly, he knows it. He knows I don't like him. I've made it pretty clear over the years, yeah. But there's a few of them like that as well, actually.
Really?
There's more than one, yeah. I mean...
Is Paul de Resta one of them? No. Or, bit like Marmite.
What makes you think that?
Don't worry.
We were competitive teammates, and that's what's difficult. When you're so competitive as teammates, it makes it very challenging to have a relationship, you know.
Well, going through all obviously greatly successful times, but as you say, also naturally frustrating too. You're keeping your toe in Formula One as well with McLaren. But then if we fast forward a little bit, you did switch to Williams, right, as an F1 tester briefly in 2016, I think it was. So what was going on at that time? Why did the switch come about? Were you still happy being a tester in Formula One?
Yeah, I left McLaren because they didn't want me involved with the team anymore because I was a Mercedes driver, and that's when they signed Honda. And Honda didn't want anyone involved with Mercedes working with them because obviously their powertrain was so incredible at the time. I think that was the one Alonso called a Formula 2 engine, wasn't it?
Yes, a GP2.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, GP2 engine, that was it. So, as soon as they started ramping up the development with Honda, they just got rid of me basically because they didn't want me around. So that was in 2013. And then I was, I didn't do anything in F1 for a couple of years. And then, an opportunity came up with Williams. You know, a few people that I know joined there, you know, especially there was a guy called Jakob Andreasen, who was an engineer at McLaren for a long time that I worked with in testing there. And he'd gone there and he was one of the senior engineers there. And he got in touch and said, you fancy doing some work for us as a test and simulator driver, basically. So developing the simulator, do some testing. I did some track testing in Bahrain, end of season test in Bahrain as well with the team. And I did a lot of work with Lance Stroll there over the winter as well, getting him up to speed, ready for his first year. So, a combination of things, actually.
Mm-hmm. And moving, skipping ahead slightly, 2018, that must have been a great year, a memorable year, but also a sad year. It was your last season in DTM. You signed off by winning the championship in Hockenheim, as we know, when I think you came third in that race, but won the championship regardless. After 15 years in that championship, two titles, four vice championship ticks against your name, what were the emotions when you decided to finally call it a day?
To be honest, I think the emotions of calling it a day happened quite early. I mean, you know, you see manufacturers come and leave championships, and a lot of them do it in quite a bad way. You know, I think that some of them, who expected Audi to pull out of LMDH like last week? Mm. You know, that really was unexpected. And I think even drivers that are expected to drive the cars didn't know before they read it in the press, which is an absolute nightmare. You know, Toto called a meeting with all the drivers 18 months before they pulled out to say, this is what we're doing. So everyone went into 2018 knowing exactly what was going to happen. You know, we were pulling out. This was the last year. You know, there wasn't any upset. We were just completely focused to make that the best year we could. And we did. You know, I think the regulations-wise, they tightened a lot of things up, stopped the... excessive spending of Audi on aero development helped them be successful, which was always the same in DTM, and it kind of suited our car, the new regulations, and we started off in the year in a really strong way. So, 2018 was a fairy tale end to it, really. You know, for me, for my whole career, that second championship was something that was missing. You know, from DTM, having won it once quite early in my career, I was hunting after that second one for years, and 2018, it just all seemed to, it all fell together. 2017 was a building year. I had two new engineers in 2017. You know, we were working together and trying to understand each other. And then 2018, everything kind of fell into place, and it all went very well. But no, there was some fantastic races, and I, you know, some years it's, if you find it very difficult to do things. 2018 for me, okay, it's always a challenge, but it was just enjoyment through driving and qualifying, especially that year. I just found the car so nice to drive, and I just for myself, you know, I've not always been the best qualifier in a car, but that year it was just excellent. You know, we were just qualifying so well, and it made the whole year so much easier, really. So it was it was an incredible way to finish, and for me, fantastic personally to get a second championship, because so many people have won one DTM championship. There's such a big list of people. Paul DeResta being one of them.
Well deserved.
Bastards.
But there is so many people that have won a championship, you know, and there's not many that have won more than one. There's not many that have won two. You know, you're quite a small group of people. So it was great to get that second championship.
Yeah, and very much well-deserved, far more so than Paul DeResta would ever have been. Now, let's skip out of DTM. Obviously, you've had a very successful and a long career there, but you've delved into the world of electric racing and worked in Formula E as development driver and then sporting and technical advisor for Mercedes EQ, who have done very, very well themselves. You're clearly doing something right to earn your keep there. Must be a great experience trying something new after all those years in DTM.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it happened quite organically, really, because HWA joined Formula E. So effectively, we actually cut the party short after winning a championship. It was incredible. We never really got a chance to celebrate the championship, because the Sunday night we cut short because we were up early Monday morning flying to Valencia for the official test on Monday. So yeah, that was most of the crew, most of the DTM people, really, the mechanics, the engineers, all of us just moved from DTM, Formula E. That's it, away you go. And the same sort of thing. We had a few, I think we had one person that had Formula E experience. The rest of us all came from DTM or somewhere else. So, the biggest reason I was there was just to help build the team, to be honest. You know, I think obviously I was a good driver as well, but just to help come and build this team and get this team to where it needed to be. And I think in 3 years from season five to the end of season seven, winning two world championships, I think we've done a pretty excellent job. And as you say, my role in that team changed quite a lot. So I was racing the car in season five. In season six, I went into a different role, which was quite vague, to be honest. It was kind of we wanted to be part of the team doing something, helping us, but not really have a job title. I think it was advisor, you know, technical and sporting advisor. And I was still reserve driver and doing simulator work at the time. That role has kind of expanded and it's obviously doing something right, because they're giving me more responsibility now. So I'm for this year, for season eight, I'm team manager now, as well as a sporting advisor for the team.
Awesome.
So, it's that side of things for me is going strength to strength, and it's something I'm really enjoying. And yeah, the feeling of winning, although not being in the car, the feeling of winning the world championship last year, drivers and teams, was just incredible. You know, such a team effort and just an incredible feeling. So I'm thoroughly enjoying it. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Well, we were going to ask what does the future hold, but clearly that's sort of where it's going, and that. That change from, you know, being in the cockpit to then being in the garage, was that, I think you said fairly natural, but has that been challenging to adapt to, or is it been something you're relishing?
I found it quite easy, to be honest. I think that the amount, you know, even when I was in DTM for so many years, I was doing a lot within the team, you know, within the structure of the team, working with the engineers, working with Uli Fritz, who obviously running in the team at the time. You know, sometimes for certain years, talking to Uli about who else we're going to sign and who's going to be whose teammate, things like this within the team. So I was for 1 year, and probably for the last few years of my DTM career at Mercedes, they effectively not even just called me, but I was the team captain of the drivers, basically. So even when I was still racing, there was if there was anything that drivers needed to be done within the team or anything else, I was the person that went to sort it out. You know, I was the team captain of drivers. So that whole organization side of things. And so it happened quite naturally for me, really. And a lot of the things I'm doing seem to just come again quite naturally to me, because of the experience I've got in DTM, in Formula One, and now obviously having raced in Formula E for a year. It's not been a massive challenge. A lot of the other stuff involved with the running of the team and management of the team are slightly different, obviously. But I think having this, the foundation that I have working as a driver at this level for so long, it's set me up pretty well.
Yeah, it certainly has. You've had a very interesting career. Now, time is against us, so we're going to move on to our final three questions, which we ask all of our guests, and they throw up a myriad of different answers.
I did see these. Yeah.
So you've done your prep. Here we go. The final three, and these questions are brought to us by our friends at F1 Experiences. Harry, do you want to kick off with number one?
Yes, Gary, what has got you excited at the moment?
At the moment, I am very excited about Formula One racing next weekend,
yeah.
Or this weekend.
This weekend.
I am. It's, you know, the start of a new season is always interesting, and the regulation changes. I can't wait to watch, to be honest. I'm still a big fan of motorsport, so yeah.
Very good.
It's boring because it's motorsport related, but...
No, we like it. And I guess it's the same for me and Harry. That's the thing we're most excited about. Well, Harry, I guess it's F3 for you. That's the thing that you're going to be most excited about this weekend. It's going to be
20 past 8, GMT, Friday morning, practice for Formula 3. Don't miss it.
I'll be there in my pants in front of the telly. There's an image for you. Okay, your second of our final three. What's your favourite racing destination for any reason?
My favourite race destination for many years was Zandvoort. Just thoroughly enjoyed driving the circuit, always went pretty well there, certainly recently, and just being there on the beach is quite unique, so definitely one of my favourites to go to.
It was certainly a massive spectacle, wasn't it, when F1 went back there last year. Final question for you, Gary, before we let you go. Paul de Resta or Bruno Spengler? No. What are you scared of? That's the actual question. And
what am I scared of? I don't know. Not a lot, to be honest.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't know what I'm scared of.
Are you okay with like bugs and stuff, like spiders?
Yeah, fine. Like spiders, bugs, all that. I'm fine with that. Okay. I haven't been around snakes too much, but you know. Held a couple and they're okay as well. So,
not afraid of anything.
No, I mean, I don't know. I probably am scared of some things, but nothing that I can think of really, you know?
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
You can have that. It's okay.
I like roller coasters, things like that. Yeah.
Bit of adrenaline junkie.
Yes.
Exactly. Well, that's what most, I suppose that's why you become a racing driver, isn't it, half the time?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, look, Gary, we have kept you for far too long already. But thank you so much for taking a bit of time out and for battling through with the countryside Wi-Fi as well. But Gary Paffett, what an absolute pleasure to get to know you a bit more and chat about your career as too. Gary, thank you so much for coming on to the Motormouth podcast.
No, thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
Before you go, one final reminder to check out F1 Experiences, the official experience, hospitality and travel program of Formula One. F1 Experiences is the closest you can get to the sport. Official ticket packages, which include the best race tickets, first class hotels, travel and exclusive behind the scenes access across a Grand Prix weekend. F1 Experiences offer packages like no other. So to book your F1 Experiences package, head online to f1experiences.com. And if you enter code Motormouth, you'll get 5% off too. Thank you so much for listening to the Motormouth podcast. Do make sure you give us a follow on our socials, Twitter at Motormouth_, Instagram at Motormouth_official, and Facebook, just search Motormouth. You can also download the Motormouth app where you can get exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile to interact with other fans, and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy. We're also proud to be supporting the Brain Tumor Charity too, so make sure you check the links in the podcast description to find out how you can help cure brain tumors quicker. Don't forget to like, subscribe and review, and until next time, you've been listening to the Motormouth podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.